So tonight we'll continue the discussion that we started 2 weeks ago. And if you recall, I believe we first raised the question, what exactly is concentration? I believe the question came as a part of a look into or an investigation into the meaning of ideas like mind, consciousness, awareness, attention, so forth. So, not all of you were here 2 weeks ago, although the talks are posted up on the website. But some of you were here 2 weeks ago. So let me ask someone who was here just to speak up a little bit, and perhaps you could either formulate a question based on where we got to last time, or maybe at least a little summary of your recollection of where we got to last time. As I recall, someone suggested that, you know, we asked the question, well, what is it that gets concentrated when you're learning concentration? So it's attention. And our investigation sort of took that as a starting point, attention. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, attention is, well, forget recollection, from your experience, what is attention? We pay attention to this, and we pay attention to that. We direct our attention to this or that. What is it that we're doing again?
Concentrating.
What's that?
Concentrating.
Well, in our daily life, we're not really concentrating when we're paying attention to all kinds of different things. But whether we're concentrating or not, attention is a really important part of, it's an essential part of what's happening in terms of our mental lives, right?
It's like you're staying with something.
Concentrating means staying with something. Attention means being with something, whether you stay or not, right? So concentration is really stability of attention. It's being able to bring a certain degree of intentional stability to where your attention is directed and how long it's sustained there. So what happens when you direct your attention at something? Or when something captures your attention? Because it can happen either way. What is it that happens in that? You are consciously aware of something, right? Mm-hmm. Now in your experience, daily life, meditation, whatever, when you direct yourself, when you direct your attention to something, is that the only thing that you are consciously aware of? No. Okay, so even if you direct your attention to something and keep your attention fixed on that, it's still not the only thing that you're conscious of, right? But if you move your attention, well, if you move your attention to a different object, then do all of the things that you're conscious of tend to change at the same time? Do some of them tend to change at the same time? Some of them do, some of them don't. Right? So like if you're, for example, if you direct your attention at one thing, say right now you direct your attention to the sensations in the sole of your left foot. Were you aware of those before I suggested it? Most of you probably weren't. Maybe somebody in here who was, for whatever reason, maybe they got a cramp in their left foot or something, but most of you weren't. But now you direct your attention there. But it's not the only thing that you're aware of. And of course, you're still aware of my voice. You're probably still aware of the sound of the fan. There's a number of things that remain in your awareness. If you shift your attention now from the sensations in the sole of your left foot to the sensations in your knee, probably you're still aware of the sensations in the sole of your left foot, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a qualitative difference. There's whatever your attention is focused on, that you are most clearly aware of. And the other things that are present at the same time, not so clearly. So attention is this thing that the mind does that can be directed and focused on one thing or another or another. And no matter what it's focused on, it tends to include some other things which you are not as clearly conscious of as the thing it's focused on, right? What the real essence of this, though, is that you're conscious of what you're paying attention to. That's the interesting idea. Because before you directed your attention to the sensations in your shoulder and your feet, you weren't conscious of them, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, you could direct your attention to sounds and just hear it. And you'll find that some of the things that you hear when you do that, you're already conscious of to some degree. But you'll discover others that you weren't conscious of. And we could repeat this in all kinds of different ways. Yeah.
There's a whole method of concentration called labeling.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've tried labeling many times, but I find that I don't like it, that it's distracting to me, that it breaks up my concentration. And so what I've been trying to do in terms of concentration is trying to just drink in what is happening right now and not labeling it and not thinking about any individual, just like it's absolutely right now, this is what's happening, and just allowing the awareness of what is happening right now. It puts my mind in a very different space, in a very still space. It's not easy to keep it there often, but I find that the labeling is really distracting. Can you comment on that? I mean, because it's almost like you enter into a hyper-present, a hyper-now. Not hyper as in busy and scattered, but hyper as in real clear, like right here, right now. A bell ringing, a plane going overhead. It's just being in the now. Does that make any sense? Or is that a valid approach?
Well, let's look into it a little bit. Now, let's compare it with labeling, okay? What is a label?
It's a word.
It's a word. And it's, what is a word?
It's a mind formation.
It's a concept. It's a symbol of a concept. It's not, the word is not the concept, but the word is a symbol for a concept. Okay. So, when you hear a sound, that's a different kind of experience than having a concept, right? and coming up with a word, a label or something, is a very different mental process than hearing sound, seeing something, feeling something. So it's a different kind of mental process. So if you are labeling your experiences, you're bouncing back and forth between two different mental processes, right? Mm-hmm. Two very different kinds of mental processes. So, what would you expect if you're jumping back and forth from doing one thing to another, back and forth, back and forth? If you stop doing two different things and stay in one mode, one mental mode of perceiving instead of jumping back and forth, what effect would you just logically, you know, if you've never experienced it, what would you predict?
What would
you predict if you stayed in a single mode of knowing rather than jumping back and forth between two all the time?
Well, it seems to be a much more direct experience. If you're not engaging in mental formations and you're just drinking things in as they are right now.
Well, you're more fully involved.
Right here, right now, and it seems to bring a sense of stillness and connectedness rather than the fragmentation of labeling.
Right. Well, and also there's a continuity, and there's in a given interval of time, more of time is spent experiencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if your brain's got to go and look up the label for everything, mm-hmm. it can't be doing that at the same time it's experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just a whole lot more present continuously. And if you do that for a period of 5 minutes, then you have a whole lot more time spent experiencing, since some proportion, like half of it, isn't spent in gone and pulling up the appropriate concept and the label that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's a really important notion, that the mind does different kinds of things. And can it do more than one thing at a time? That's the question. What do you think? You think it can? Okay.
I'm not sure we experience it that way, though, in the nanosecond.
Well,
things tend to be, you're aware of this and you're aware of that, your mind goes from here to there.
Mm-hmm. There's a real question. Can the mind really do more than one thing at once, or does it jump back and forth between them so quickly it seems like it's doing more than one thing at once? And we don't really need to figure out the answer to that, although it's an interesting question and it's an interesting thing to observe your mind, especially in meditation. But you can make this observation of your mind at any time. Just hold that question. Just, you know, can my mind really do two things at once, or is it jumping back and forth between doing two different things? And it only does one at a time. Or is the answer not either one or the other, but some combination? But isn't it already intuitively clear from all of your cumulative experience that whether you're jumping back and forth between two things or whether your mind is doing two things at once, in either case, if it's doing two things, it's not doing either one quite as fully as it would if it was by itself, right? So we've made a little more sense out of it already. So yeah, if you do a practice that involves labeling, you are going to definitely become aware of the expenditure of your resources, your mental resources, your consciousness, for the labeling process that must in some way or another take away from the other ways of experiencing things. Bob, you had something to say?
I heard on the radio news some study of the effect of multitasking and how it's effective.
Yeah.
As people do. We're trying to do one thing at a time. I know for me that's pretty.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And multitasking is something that's very common nowadays, right? And yeah, and why do we multitask? Well, I multitask, and very often because I'm waiting for the computer to continue to finish doing something, and rather than just sit there and wait, I initiate something else at the same time.
I'm standing in line to do that. I don't know whether that's really multitasking.
Yeah. Well, I think it's you can sort of generalize it that we think we're going to be more efficient because we perceive that there's unused time or there's unused mental resources. Maybe part of what we're doing involves some mechanical activity, and we figure the mind could be doing something else during that period. So that's why the temptation there is to multitask. And if we could do it with the utmost efficiency, then we would probably see a positive return. It's very easy for when we're multitasking for both tasks, or all three tasks, or all seven tasks, to begin to suffer because you're not utilizing your available mental resources, time resources, and everything as efficiently as possible. But this relates to what we're talking about, what we do with our mind. Our mind is always doing many things. This is how we go through our daily lives. Right? And so it's relevant to what we're talking about, and it's relevant to why we meditate. Yeah.
Well, in defense of labeling, I mean, there must be a reason why some people use it, and it must have some positive effect for people that do it, right? I mean, if they're not doing it to quiet their mind, I think they're doing it to observe what their mind is doing.
Yes, they're doing it to observe. But they're also doing it for exactly the reason that Pam objects to it. Pam objects to labeling because it takes her away from being totally involved with the experience that she labels. Right? What's that?
Well, there is a reason. Some people do it for a good reason for a while, and
maybe
at some point they don't need to.
That's right. But with any kind of technique, you start off doing it for a good reason, it serves a purpose, and sometimes you outgrow that reason, and so it's no longer serving the purpose anymore. It's like meditating on the breath, and you start off counting. And then after a while, counting doesn't do any good anymore. So you stop doing it. So you leave things behind. Labeling can serve a number of different purposes in different meditation techniques. And they're not always the same. But by looking at them, it helps us to understand how the mind is working. Now, What I wanted to point out about what Pam said. Pam said she tries things that involve labeling, and if she labels, it removes her from the experience. Right? With some meditation techniques, that is the whole idea. I think most of you are at least passingly familiar with Shinzen's labeling technique. Right? And so what he says is, when there's talk taking place, you label it talk. When there's mental images arising, you label it image. When there's feelings arising, you label it feeling. And the whole purpose of that is to keep you from getting too involved and caught up in the mental talk, in the mental imagery, in the feelings that are arising. so that you remain objective, you remain separated from it. So that's the whole point of labeling in that particular method. You know, and that's what he, that's what he'll tell you. He'll say, my strategy is divide and conquer. All this stuff gets entangled in our minds and we can't tell who we are or what we are or what we're doing, and all we do is feel confused and angry or unhappy or whatever our emotional state is, you know. But he uses labeling technique to keep, and then they all start going, oh, there's those thoughts, oh, there's those images, oh, there's those feelings, and you can see them separately for what they are. So the whole idea is not, it is to use the act of labeling, not to get caught up in it. In some stages of concentration practice, we do the same thing. So if you're having a lot of distractions come up, you know, you keep thinking about the plans for your vacation, or you keep thinking about this problem that you have at work, and those things come up, you can practice, if it's not enough to just recognize a distraction, let go of it, and come back to the meditation object, you start labeling it. The labeling act will pull you out of the thought process. And one of my favorite ways of using labeling for that purpose is when you're experiencing a lot of distraction, you label it. You always need some simple system. Otherwise, you spend, you know, some thought comes up, and then you spend the next 3 minutes trying to figure out the right label for it. You know? So, you know, like with Shinsen's or like with other methods, you always need some simple system that you can apply so the tool really works. So the one that I like is you label them according to the five hindrances. This is a thought associated with worldly desire. This is a thought associated with aversion. This is a thought associated with laziness and procrastination. This is a thought associated with worry or remorse. This is a thought associated with doubt. And so you just, you label it. But the labeling of it, you're fully aware of it, but you stayed outside of it. And this, I shouldn't say stayed outside of it. Actually, you were sucked into it, but you pulled yourself back out of it through the act of labeling. So that's one of the purposes that labeling serves. And once again, it illustrates, as in the same way that Shinzen used it, different mental processes. Whether you can do them both at the same time, or whether your mind's going back and forth, and we can leave that as an open question, but nevertheless, different mental processes occur at the expense of others. Right? This is a general principle you can apply to your mind. That, you know, if any two things that you're doing at once are going to take place at the expense of the other, at least in terms of how fully you could be engaged with and involved with either one by itself. That's an important principle in how the mind works. We'll go back to how the mind is working. I'll just briefly mention to you another powerful meditation technique that uses labeling. And that's the Vipassana technique that's developed by Mahasi. There, the labels you use is you label the activity that's taking place. So, you find your attention go to the sign of the fan, and you say, hearing, hearing. And then you find that you're remembering something, you're remembering how good the watermelon and pancakes were at breakfast, so remembering. And it's touching, it's hearing, it's thinking, it's remembering. So you put these labels on what you're doing. And you actually get very fast at it. So that as fast as something comes up in your mind, you put the label on it. And at some point, your whole experience, it just becomes totally clear that, wow, there's sensations and then there's labels. This is what my whole life has been about. Sensations happen, and then I label them. Rupa, mama, rupa, mama, two different things. And then you say, what is rupa? And so now you're sitting there having these sensations arise and labeling them, but a part of your mind is realizing these sensations don't have any meaning until the nama, until the label comes up. You know? So you're starting at that point to have some insight into the way things really are. And when you continue this process, and it's a difficult one, I'll tell you, amongst the meditation techniques that you can try to do, the Mahasi style labeling technique is one that it is going to, it's going to test your discipline and your patience to do. But if you follow through it, your mind will just get into this rhythm of everything that happens, a label comes up right after it. And it's really clear to you at this point that this is the sensation, this is the concept. This is the rupa, and this is the nama. And this is the rupa, and this is the nama. And you have this experiencing of the rising and passing away of phenomena of our whole existence. The arising of rupa, which immediately passes away. Even if you hear the sound of a plane fly over, it's not a sound of a plane flying over. It is this repeated sequence of many different sounds following right after another. And so you start to have this clear knowledge and perception of how phenomena and how mental events arise and pass away. And then if you keep following through that, you start to really see the impermanence of everything, the passing away of it. So that's the way things like labeling techniques, all these different meditation techniques, they're because somebody has had some profound understanding of the way the mind works, and also has a profound understanding of the truth, of the reality that's waiting to be discovered, and that is going to bring us to a more fully awakened and liberated degree of understanding, and has created a technique that makes use of how the mind works to bring us to the state of insight, of awareness. So that's what all these meditation techniques are doing. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about how the mind works. Attention, consciousness, awareness. What is this stuff? I mean, we all know what these words mean, but how fully do we understand what they are? And perhaps if we understand them and understand the relationship between them and meditation practice, it will have a positive, beneficial effect on our meditation practice. And also help us to know where we're going and why we're doing this practice anyway. Because, you know, I don't know how you came to meditation, but many years ago I came to meditation and, well, sounds like a really cool thing. I really like the idea of what people meditate a lot can do. You know, and then meditation teacher says, well, do this. And then there's some point where I have absolutely no idea what this thing that I'm doing has to do with what I wanted when I decided to find out about meditation in the first place. You know, how is watching my breath going to bring me peace and happiness and insight? Anyway, let's continue exploring the nature of the mind. So attention, we go through our lives experiencing this phenomenon of attention. And let me see if you agree with my description of attention is that it can be directed at different things at different times. And wherever it's directed, there's something that is the focus of attention. And then there are other things that are present as a part of that, that they're present in our conscious awareness, but that are not at the focus. So they're kind of in the periphery, right? And that, so So let's let my hands represent this shape. This is attention. So it has a focus, and it has the other stuff around it. And what's really interesting is that what's inside the scope of my attention, I'm conscious of. And what's outside the scope of my attention, I'm not conscious of. But if I have the scope of, I have the focus of my attention over here, there are certain things that I'm aware of, consciously aware of as well. If I change the focus of my attention, the accompanying things change as well. Right? And some of the things that I was consciously aware of before, when my attention moves, they're no longer there. So attention has a focus and it has a scope. And it has those things that we're very consciously aware of because they're at the focus. And it has those things that we're not so fully consciously aware of because they're more in the periphery. And outside of the sphere of our attention is all that other stuff that we're not consciously aware of, but we could be. So consciousness, whatever consciousness is, it's what happens in relationship to attention. And attention somehow has the effect of determining what you're going to be conscious of as opposed to what you're not conscious of. Okay? So that's my description of attention. Does that fit with your experience? See any errors or contradictions or anything in that? Now, I find at this point I need two words to describe a difference in the experiential phenomena. And what I'm seeking to discern a difference between or discriminate between is, are those things that somehow register in your on your nervous system, on your mind at some level, and we know they register because they produce effects. They produce responses. Like, you're sitting and some part of your body becomes uncomfortable. And you will move. Well, there's two possibilities. One is that you were consciously aware of that gradually increasing discomfort, and you consciously, with conscious awareness, made a move. But this is hard to observe in yourself initially, but you can. But it's easy to observe in somebody else. You'll see that everybody is always moving, and you can be pretty darn sure that a lot of those movements they're not conscious of, or of the cause for the movement. You know what I mean? And if you observe yourself carefully, what you're going to discover is that movements have taken place and you have no awareness of why or when it happened. Or you have no consciousness. So this is what this is the two phenomena that I want you to think about, and I think are very important, is that things can have an impact, can make an impression, can register on the body, on the nervous system, on the mind, and we can know that they did so because they produce effects, but we will have no conscious awareness of them. Right? Yet, any of those things we could have been conscious of, but we're not. We weren't for some reason. You know, if you and I are having a conversation, I could notice that a fly landed on your arm and you brushed it off. And if I don't say anything for 2 or 3 minutes, and then I'll say, did you know that a fly landed on your arm and you brushed it off? There's a good chance you'll say, no, when did that happen? But it produced a very obvious effect. And psychologists do a kind of research on subliminal stimuli. I think you've probably all heard of subliminal advertising and things like that, which is based on this, because it's a well-established fact in the laboratory that an image or a word or sound can register on your nervous system to the extent that it changes your behavior. It changes the answer you give to a question 5 minutes later. Or it changes the motor response that you make in response to some other supraliminal stimulus. So it has an effect and it's changed your behavior, but it's below the threshold of what you can be consciously aware of. So we have things that we act on, things that influence us, things that result in behaviors, and not just behaviors that result in emotional reactions, thought processes, and everything else, that we can either be conscious of or not conscious of. And so that's where I'm looking for the words. Like, what words do we have available to distinguish between the ones that we're consciously aware of and the ones that we're not? Now, I'm going to suggest something. Yeah, that consciousness and awareness, we use them sort of interchangeably, right? But what I'm talking about now, that we are either conscious of something or not, the word consciousness is really specific to some kind of subjective experience and knowing, right? So the ones like the fly that landed that you brushed off, but you were so engaged with something else that it didn't, you know, you were not conscious of it. So consciousness, I think we need to, just for convenience sake in discussion, let's reserve the word consciousness to those phenomena that correspond to the way we most often use it. Those that we have a definite subjective experience of. And that leaves us searching for another word for those things that we could be conscious of, but we're sometimes not. But they nevertheless have an effect on us. And so I'd suggest that we use the other word, awareness. It's more a general term. So you could say that we can be aware of all kinds of things, but we are only consciously aware of those that produce that definite subjective experience.
So consciousness is we know that we know.
You know that you know, yeah.
And awareness is?
It makes something happen, but we don't know that we know it.
That's the fly example.
Yeah.
On some level, we're brushing off a fly, but we don't know that we're brushing off a fly. It's sort of like almost like a...
We don't know that we know.
It's a reflex.
That's right. It's automatic. It's unconscious.
And then there's the word mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Would you equate consciousness then with mindfulness?
Somehow absolutely.
They're in the ballpark.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, absolutely. So when we say to be mindful, that means to know that we know. That means to be consciously aware. And just to clarify this further, using this idea of things that we're aware of but not conscious of, as opposed to things that we're conscious of, we're aware of and conscious of, we realize that in any given moment, there's a huge amount of things that we're aware of because we have the potential to respond to them. But there's only a very small select portion that we're conscious of. And we have a limited capacity for consciousness. Right? Everybody's had the experience of driving a car while carrying on a conversation. And when you come out of the conversation for a moment, you're not even sure where you are. You have to look around. Okay? Everyone's had that experience. And this happens all the time. We can drive the car automatically. We can stop at stoplights and stop signs. We can avoid obstacles. We can not run into the car ahead of us. Our eyes register somebody else's brake lights coming on. our brain initiates the activity of moving the foot from the gas to the brake, all without any involvement of consciousness. But in the sense that I was using awareness, there's obviously awareness there. Awareness and action, and the whole thing is taking place in quite a wonderful way. Well, you look at your life. You go through the world, you go through your life day by day, acting out of awareness, a huge proportion of which is unconscious. Mindfulness is about making use of that limited capacity for conscious awareness. We're, most of the time that you're awake, you're consciously aware of things. You know that you know something, even though there's a whole lot of other stuff that you don't know that you know. But we go through our lives with this conscious awareness, not necessarily functioning optimally. And this brings us back to attention. Attention is that small part of awareness that we're conscious of the contents of. And then everything else that you're aware of, you're not conscious of. So attention is that small, that portion, that limited portion of overall awareness of which you have consciousness. Consciousness is present. There is conscious awareness. And mindfulness. Mindfulness is the contents of conscious awareness. It's the contents of attention, right? It's not anything else but that. So, we talked about practicing mindful awareness in our speech and our action. And we talk, and we do. We say without thinking, but what we mean is that we're not really conscious of what we're doing. Well, we hear the words that come out of our mouth, but we're not really consciously aware of why we're doing it and whether or not it's appropriate, whether or not it's a good idea. It just happens. Mindfulness means bringing that attention, bringing that conscious awareness to play, to allow us to investigate what it really means to be us in the world. Just like it does in meditation. You sit down and you focus on the meditation object, but your mindfulness, if you focus on the meditation object, you will have a high degree of conscious awareness of the meditation object for a while, until maybe your attention starts to go elsewhere. Or sometimes the scope of your attention gets broad, and of course, the broader your scope of attention, the less clear what's at the focus of it is. In meditation, what are we learning to do? We're learning to control the direction of attention so that the attention is directed by our deliberate volitional intention, conscious intention. Here we come back to consciousness again. Our intentions can be, just like our sensory experiences, our intentions can be either conscious or unconscious. And we do a lot of our ordinary activity out of unconscious intention, right? As opposed to conscious intention. So mindfulness practice is about, it's also about being consciously aware of the intentions that lie behind our actions. So in meditation, when we say we're concentrating, is it not true that we mean we're learning to stabilize the direction of our attention so that it's not constantly wandering from this to that, and this to that, and the other thing, just wandering at random. And we're able to sustain the attention. And we're also learning to control how focused, how broad the scope of the attention is, how how clearly conscious we are of what's at the focus as compared to the other things that are present at the same time. So we're exercising these capacities that we have. Normally what happens is your attention rests on something. This outside of meditation. Well, this is outside of meditation in daily life, and this is in meditation before you get very good at it. Your attention rests on something until that something seems to hold no further appeal, interest, attraction, novelty, right? And then the mind spontaneously moves in search of something else, more interesting. Or, the other thing that happens is your mind, your attention is focused on one thing, and something else comes into that peripheral awareness that looks more interesting and appealing, and the focus of attention jumps over to it. So we can say the normal situation is that there's some sort of inherent mechanism of mind that causes it to constantly be moving around from one thing, the attention to be moving from one thing to another, to look for something that is more important or more interesting than whatever it is we're attending to at the present, right? And that's an important thing, right? We've already established we have a huge capacity for awareness, but only a limited capacity for conscious awareness. So, if conscious awareness serves any purpose at all, and we have such a limited capacity for it, then we need some mechanism to make sure that we are paying attention to what is most important, most relevant to us, right? So that's how we come into the world, with this mechanism that sustains the attention for just so long and then says, eh, this is not so interesting anymore, and frees the attention, and now the attention scoots over to something else. And then it's sustained on that by this spontaneous automatic mechanism for so long as it seems fascinating until that set of undulating hips passes around the corner or for you ladies, whatever they're comfortable. And then it goes off to something else, right? And this assures, this is a good thing, it assures that in the course of our life, we'll notice those things and we'll devote some conscious attention to the things that are most likely to matter and be significant for our survival and our well-being, and to gratify our desires and our needs, and then to avoid the pain and suffering that might otherwise arise. So it's a good mechanism. But what we're trying to do in meditation is we're going to do something else that we're quite capable of doing, which is intentionally directing the attention. Say, I'm going to pay attention to that. That mechanism is already there. It's very important. We use it all the time, every day. So we have these two different mechanisms which are sort of, more or less, you know, in conflict with each other. And in meditation, we're practicing the directing attention mechanism so that it starts responding to our will, our intention, rather than just, you know, doing this hunt-and-seek behavior. And the same thing, we've got that other mechanism that decides how long the attention stays on something, the sustained attention mechanism. It operates on its built-in programming, but we also have the capacity to sustain our attention on something longer when we need to, right? When there's an algebra exam, the next morning in the ninth grade, we learned that we could sustain our attention long enough to read all three of the chapters that we were supposed to cover in the last 6 weeks. Or some such similar experience. I know you've all been through that. So we have the capacity to sustain our attention given sufficient motivation. So we're in meditation, we're training the faculties of directed and sustained attention. Why? Why? Because this most important thing, conscious awareness, occurs where there is attention. And as we talked about last week, considering that you have limited capacity for conscious awareness, what you pay attention to, your life consists of what you pay attention to. So you and I walk down the same street, you pay attention to certain things, and so you had your experience of the street was this, and it might be wonderful and beautiful. And I walked down the same street, and I paid attention to a different thing, and I might have had a very disappointing experience. So we walked down two completely different streets, because the streets that we walked down were the streets constructed by the attentional activity of our mind. Out of an infinite number of possible streets we could have walked down, the ones we actually walked down were the ones that we subjectively experienced through conscious awareness, which is to say, the streets made up of those things that we did pay attention to as opposed to those that we didn't pay attention to. And I'll just add one more little thing to this. This picture we're painting. Okay, this is the scope of my attention, and this is the focus of my attention. We've already seen that the bigger the scope of attention, the less clear the things of focus are, because we're redistributing the resources, right? But the other thing that we can do is we can increase the amount of conscious awareness that occurs within a given scope of attention. We can become more fully conscious. Is this too tricky an idea for you? We've all been in those states where we're just not that sharply, we're aware of what we pay attention to, but not really very. And we've all been in those places where there's this huge power of conscious awareness that comes into it. So we recognize that it's like, you know, if you compare attention to a beam of light that can be moved around and it can be spread and narrowed. The other thing that we can say about this beam of light is that it has this little rheostat here that can increase the juice going to the filament. It can become a whole lot brighter, a whole lot less bright. Which of course means if you make it a whole lot brighter, you can spread the beam, and instead of what's at the focus of the attention becoming less clear, dimmer, vaguer, it remains just as bright and clear, but now you're taking in a whole lot more, and you're more fully aware of that as well. So this is, in terms of mindfulness, mindful awareness, sati, you should think of sati, mindful awareness, as the power of a conscious awareness, and that it can definitely be raised to a higher level than you ordinarily function at. And also, it doesn't need to sink to such a low level as it often does in periods during the course of your day. So, mindful awareness, when we speak of mindful awareness, we need to think of it in terms of what is the power of consciousness that is being generated within this particular scope of awareness. And how fully and totally conscious are we of not only what's at the focus, but also what's in the periphery of it. Now, we still haven't even addressed the question. We'll have to wait until I get back from Canada, things like that. Well, what is this consciousness stuff anyway? What's it good for? I mean, that's the question. What's it good for? If I can drive my car across town unconsciously, what on earth do I need consciousness for? And I'm sure you already, your mind already is coming up with, well, you know some of the things that consciousness is good for. That all those automatic processes are pretty limiting. And also, if you remember when you learned to drive, boy, were you ever super conscious of every little tiny thing. Yeah. That's how those automatic processes that we can do unconsciously come about, is we use a whole lot of conscious awareness at some point to create that. So anyway, we'll, on another occasion, we'll get more into what is this consciousness stuff, what's it good for, where does it come from, so on and so forth. But What do you think of, have we clarified the idea of what attention is all about and how, at least how it relates to consciousness? Mm-hmm. Any comments or thoughts? Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about the experience I have had that sounds to me like it fits into what you're saying exactly.
That is what?
That it sounds like it fits into what you're saying about consciousness exactly.
Yeah.
But I want to see what you have to say about it, which is that there's been many, many, many times in my life when I'll look back at something that is happening that I'm very displeased about. I review it in my mind and I would say, this happened, and then I had the thought, maybe I shouldn't do that, but I did it anyway. I'm so stupid. But after this has happened throughout my life, maybe hundreds or thousands of times, it finally occurred to me that I'm remembering that I had the thought of maybe I shouldn't do this, or maybe I should do it a different way, but maybe the thought never hit consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm remembering that it did.
You remember that it was there.
I'm remembering that it was there, and I assumed, I mean, it wouldn't occur to me to say it didn't hit consciousness, but I finally hit a point in my life where I thought, I'm not sure I had that thought. Because if I had had that thought, I would have done something different. And so that kind of made me a little bit kinder to myself when that kind of thing happened. Right. So is that what you're talking about?
That is what I'm talking about, yes. And that specific example illustrates an important point. And to me, this is the way I see it. That, you know, if we compare attention to a beam of light, you know that a beam of light doesn't really have a completely sharp edge. It gradually fades out. And superficially, it may seem like, yeah, everything over there is in the dark. This is the stuff that's illuminated. But there really is no sharp, clear line. What I would have said about that thought you had is it's one that was, it was just enough on the edge there that you could have the recollection of it. It almost came into consciousness. If it had stayed further out in the really dark area, then the thought would have been, you know, boy, I wish I had had a thought like that. But the sensation that you already knew, but you didn't really, it didn't really get in there to the point that it could play a significant part in the decision making process. Right. So it illustrates the point that there isn't really a sharp line between that of which we have some degree of consciousness and that of which we have none. It fades out. And the other thing, too, is we can direct consciousness here and there, and we can hold our attention here and there, and we can hold attention still. But even if we hold attention still, stuff can enter our field of conscious awareness, and it can leave our field of conscious awareness, even while conscious awareness stays still. Which, of course, a corollary of is something that is moving and changing. Conscious awareness can move to follow the object and to stay with it. But yeah, we have the right ideas that come into conscious awareness sometimes, and then we lose them again, and they don't get to participate in the process of making the decision, and then we feel badly. And we imagine that instead of being a forum, the members of which come and go on their own, we imagine ourselves to be this real, substantially existent entity called the self, and we blame ourself and hit the head part of our five aggregates a few times because we're blaming this imaginary self for letting that happen.
That's a whole other topic.
Those are all connected. If we just keep going here, it'll keep unfolding for us. So You find this interesting? Can we continue this thing?
Yes.
Okay. We'll get more into consciousness and the nature of mind. We'll explore some interesting concepts like knowledge, wisdom, and insight. Okay. Well, it's now past time to bring this to a close, so I want to thank you very, very much.